From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. NATO's 20-year mission in Afghanistan is all but over. But Taliban attacks continue, and there is growing concern about the country's future. In April, President Biden said he's ending the U.S. role in the war, but not its commitment.
Our troops are coming home, but we agreed that our diplomatic, economic, and humanitarian commitment to the Afghan people and our support for the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces will endure.
We've had a number of conversations about Afghanistan since Biden announced in April that he was ending the war, and we want to continue today with James Stavridis. He's a retired U.S. Naval Admiral and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. In that role, he commanded the NATO mission in Afghanistan from 2009 to 2013. Admiral Stavridis, welcome back to the program.
Great to be on with you, Jane.
As you watch this American withdrawal from Afghanistan, I'm curious what is going through your mind.
Well, first of all, when I commanded that mission, and as you know, it's a NATO mission, we had 150,000 coalition troops there. We're now down to somewhere around a few thousand. So the vast majority of these troops came home a long time ago. I do believe that as we end the military involvement here, it's going to be crucial, as President Biden said, that we continue our efforts in security assistance in terms of funding the Afghan security forces, in terms of the diplomatic, economic development. All of that are going to be very important if we're going to avoid what we all want to avoid, which is Vietnam circa 1975, like helicopters lifting off the roof of the embassy. We can still avoid that. It's going to be challenging.
Well, there are many, as you well know, who say that Afghanistan will or could collapse into a terrible scenario, chaos or worse, civil war after the U.S. troops leave. The Taliban is clearly surging across the country at this moment, taking control of territory. I want to play this clip from ABC's Martha Raddatz speaking with the commander of the U.S.-led mission in Afghanistan, General Scott Miller. Take a listen.
I've talked to a lot of Afghans. They're very concerned that the Taliban will move into Kabul. How likely is that?
If you go back to what the Taliban's objectives are, they want to take over. You know, that implies that at some point they are in Kabul.
So, Admiral, if the Taliban were to take over Kabul, wouldn't Afghanistan be right back where it was before the U.S.-led invasion in 2001?
Unfortunately, in many ways, I think it would. And that would be a tragedy, in my view, when you look at all the progress we have made in human rights, women's rights, education for girls, life expectancy, medical accessibility, a global engagement for Afghanistan, a democracy, although not a perfect democracy. There's been enormous progress, and I think that is highly at risk if the Taliban sweep back in. I think there's still a 1 in 3 chance that if we continue to engage, we provide the funding for the Afghan security forces, we exercise the kind of diplomatic influence, we keep the airports open. I think there's a 1 in 3 chance that they could be held off, and we end up with what we want, which is a settlement between the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan that preserves the gains we've made. Still a chance for that.
Well, from a national security perspective, the big concern that you hear often is that an Afghanistan controlled by the Taliban again could become a place where another terrorist attack against the U.S. is planned. It sounds like, I mean, you share that view possibly. I mean, it just depends on what happens.
Indeed, it does. And here, the Biden administration is working hard, and I know this through my contacts in the Pentagon, to come up with a credible over-the-horizon strategy that if the Taliban were foolish enough, let's hypothesize that they come into power, if they were foolish enough to allow a resurge in al-Qaeda, to allow an Islamic State to take root, we would have credible military options to come in and accomplish what has been our fundamental objective here, which is to prevent attacks on the homeland. And I'll close, Jane, by saying people often say to me, as a veteran of the Afghan wars, you know, aren't you feeling as though you failed in your mission? And I say, no. For 20 years, there's been no attack on the United States that came out of a previously ungoverned Afghanistan. I did my mission. I hope that going forward, we can still say that. And if we're going to pull the troops out, that we have an over-the-horizon capability to counter it.
Admiral, let me move on with you to some other topics. President Biden is pushing for the United States to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. To your mind, is this a good idea?
I don't think so at this point. What President Biden said on the campaign trail, with which I agree, is that it would be a longer and stronger deal. That I would agree with. If we could extend the time frame, if we could strengthen it to include anti-ballistic missile sanctions, if we could constrain Iranian bad behavior around the region, if the deal could be longer and stronger, then yes, I would support it. But simply going back to the 2015 deal, to me, does not solve the problem of preventing the Iranians from marching onward toward culminating with the nuclear weapons.
And so what about the recent airstrikes that targeted Iranian militia groups in Iraq and Syria? Were they justified? Were they necessary?
They were 100% justified because there were attacks coming from those bases against U.S. troops in Iraq. Many listeners may not have focused on the fact that we still have several thousand U.S. troops in Iraq, quite importantly, supporting the Iraqi security forces as they combat the remnants of the Islamic State. The Iranians who support these militias were launching UAV attacks against some of our troop concentrations. This was a very justifiable act of self-defense. I support those strikes.
As we've mentioned, you are also a former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. We recently spoke with a military analyst, Andrew Basevich. He made the case that NATO today is obsolete. And I want to play a clip from that interview, and then I want to get your response.
The continent may have certain problems. We all have problems. But it's stable. It's democratic. It's prosperous. Its adversary is no longer the Soviet Union. It's now Russia, which, if I'm not mistaken, has a GDP equivalent of Italy's. So Europe is perfectly capable of managing, providing for its own security.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say you probably don't agree with that. Admiral, your thoughts?
I don't. I know Dr. Colonel Andy well, and we've had many conversations over the years. I think NATO has an ongoing purpose, and to confine the purpose of NATO to defeating the Soviet Union kind of misses the larger point. History doesn't end, despite Francis Fukuyama's books alleging that. History has marched on. And so the U.S. ought to be cultivating our allies, partners, and friends in Europe, because there are still problems in that region coming from Syria, which is on a NATO border, coming across the Mediterranean, in the Arctic, in cyber. There are still many challenges out there. And having good, strong allies is something we should treasure. The Europeans could spend more on defense. They can certainly afford it. I would encourage them to do so. I did so as Supreme Allied Commander. That is an important part of it, but I wouldn't get rid of NATO. I think it's still a force for good in the world.
How serious and significant is Russia as a threat to U.S. national security today?
Well, let's observe that if Vladimir Putin woke up on Tuesday and decided to end the world by launching a nuclear strike, he could. He's got thousands of nuclear weapons. So by definition, they are a significant threat when they discuss aggressive military activities. Secondly, we watch Vladimir Putin invade Ukraine, annex Crimea, support a war criminal in Syria, conduct cyber attacks against U.S. corporations, and worst of all, attempt to intrude in our democratic elections. So, yeah, I think Russia's a quite significant challenge, although they don't have a massive GDP. They have nuclear weapons. They have ambition. They have a professional military. And I think they're going to continue to play the role of kind of a spoiler in international relations going forward.
Let me move to China for a moment. You recently co-authored a novel with Elliot Ackerman. It's called 2034, a novel of the next world war. And you imagine a naval clash between the United States and China in the South China Sea that year. As I've read part of it, I'm curious, how far from fiction is that scenario?
Well, it hit number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list, and my response when people congratulate me is, let's hope it stays on the fiction side of the list.
Yes.
I would say it is a possibility that if we are not mindful of the concern of a miscalculation, we could stumble into a war. People have said to me, oh, you've written another Cold War kind of cautionary tale. Not exactly. This is more pre-World War I. Intertwined economies, royal families related by blood and marriage, yet the nations of Europe stumbled into, sleepwalked into a conflagration that ultimately killed 80 million people when you count World War I and World War II. Could that happen with the U.S. and China? Unfortunately. That's why I've written the book, not, let us hope, as predictive fiction, but as cautionary fiction.
Retired Admiral and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander James Stavridis. Admiral, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure to be on, Jane. Thank you.
Here we are. Day 12. It's hard to believe that it's been 12 long days.
That's Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Caba providing an update to reporters this morning. On this national holiday, search and rescue teams have returned to work scouring rubble at the site of the collapsed condo building in Surfside, Florida, after demolition crews brought down what remained of the 12-story high-rise in a string of controlled explosions last night. The demolition timeline moved up considerably because of concerns that Tropical Storm Elsa could cause the rest of the structure to collapse. We're joined by NPR's Brian Mann in nearby Miami Beach. And Brian, 27 people are confirmed dead. About 120 are still missing. What we've heard is that the demolition last night has opened up more ways now to search for survivors. Tell us more about that, Brian.
Yeah, that's right. There was a whole area of that rubble pile that we've all seen images of now that was not accessible because this heavily damaged structure was looming above. It just wasn't safe to get in there. And so now those crews are able to access that area. And in fact, they have had some success in finding victims. I know that's not, you know, happy news that three bodies were found, no survivors. But this does mean that more families will be getting closure, more people, you know, will be learning what happened to their loved ones. I should say that officials here are still calling this a search and rescue mission. They were asked about that today very, very closely by reporters. They say, we still believe a miracle is possible.
And then there's the hardship and the trauma faced by those who actually lived in the part of the building that was demolished last night. Here is Surfside Mayor Charles Burkett telling Layla Faldin on Morning Edition about that.
We acknowledge that their lives have been completely torn apart. We acknowledge that they've lost their homes and all their possessions. There's no worse disaster probably, short of, you know, themselves being victims in that collapse that they could have experienced. Mm-hmm.
Were residents able to get any of their belongings, Brian, or even pets out of the building? And what do we know about their homes and where they go now?
Yeah, so to that last question first, FEMA is here, and there is a huge outpouring of generous donations to help people restart their lives. But the short answer is that this has been a devastating loss. Many people have clearly lost their lives. But yeah, these folks just saw their homes go down in a tower of rubble and dust last night. People did have to leave pets behind. There was an effort to make sure no animals were still alive in there. People also lost furniture, possessions, mementos. It was a terrible moment for a lot of those families, late last night when those explosions went off.
Oh, so terrible. Did last night's demolition give engineers any better idea about what caused the condo building to collapse in the first place?
At this point, they're saying that they don't have those kinds of answers. They did come in and really probe that structure before they demolished the standing building. The investigations are underway. But as of right now, they're not giving us any new insight into what may have caused this, you know, devastating event that started all this 12 days ago.
About 30 seconds, Brian. We've heard that Miami Beach has ordered the evacuation of at least two residential buildings in the area out of an abundance of caution. What do you know about that?
Well, I think that people are finding that there's just a lot of structures out there that need to be looked at, maintenance that has not been taken care of, inspections that have not been properly conducted, and there's now this aggressive effort to get in there and see which buildings might be safe and what might have to be done to make sure they stay safe for residents going forward.
Much more work ahead. That's NPR's Brian Mann. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This time last year, most of us were under pandemic restrictions, unable to be with family and friends to celebrate this American holiday. And the 12 months since have been tumultuous. Millions of Americans lost family and loved ones to COVID-19. And that loss has defined this year for so many. We've also experienced a renewed racial reckoning following the shooting death of Breonna Taylor in March of 2020 and the murder of George Floyd in May of last year. And then there was the 2020 election, the false claims of vote rigging, and the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And so, on this holiday, we're asking Here and Now listeners to reflect on the past year and what it is to be American in 2021.
My name is Drew Baker. I'm 45 years old. I am an attorney. My family is from the United States. You know, we were slaves. So the only country I know in terms of knowing well is this country. I don't have any other reference point. I feel like now is a backward in time moment. I feel like we're moving backward in terms of some of these voter suppressing laws, which are being passed, and just how we are moving through the country with different mindsets, depending on what media outlet we watch or listen to. So, you know, that concerns me in terms of how I feel is about being an American right now. I feel like my being a happy American is at risk.
My name is Mike Ahern. I live in Blackwick, Ohio. I'm 52 years old. I'm retired. And the past year has really brought me to think deeper about the history of our country and what the ideals of our country really represent. It was a call to action for me as an individual to support fellow Americans who haven't benefited nearly in the ways that maybe someone like myself has in the past. And so it's important for me as an individual to support my country by continuing to try to uphold those ideals. I think of myself over this past year as beginning to wrap myself in the ideals of the country and not the flag itself.
My name is Penny Maliska. I'm 59 years old. I'm from a small town in north central Massachusetts. It's called Winchendon. In the past year, the pandemic has caused me to think about being an American by combining what it means to be a parent to kids that I love and doing the right thing and doing the best thing can sometimes be the hardest thing. And I guess we all just had to get used to that. I know it's easier for some people than others, and I think a lot of people just feel a sense of relief that we can go back to caring about people that we care about in more usual ways, and that feels good.
My name is Dingane Mtetwa. I am 55 years old. I'm a school teacher. I'm thinking about the people that are in this country that are all fighting to be included. If we love this country, I feel like all these people, like we have a chance to include all these people. So seeing what has been happening, especially last year or these past few years, have really made me to think about who do we want to be? There's a lot that we're not owning, things that have happened in this country, especially the past. And I feel like we're trying to move forward without owning the past.
My name is Alexandra Cole, and I live in Ridgewood, New York. So patriotism, or being patriotic, has never been something that I really identified with. In large part, it was never so much that I didn't appreciate or don't appreciate certain parts of living in America, but I was and am still very skeptical of this idea of America being such a great country. And so patriotism has really come to mean to me a way that people put a positive spin on choices that are actually just really racist, xenophobic, or harmful to other marginalized groups in America. And it's a way for them to avoid looking at our country's past in a critical manner. And it just never sits well with me to choose the abstract country over the people who actually live in it.
My name is Brandon Smith. I am a 46-year-old from Cleveland, Ohio. I am a public affairs specialist for a federal government agency. For the past year, the pandemic and everything that's been related to it has made me think about being American from the perspective of you can love something, you can love a country, but you can still want it to be better. America isn't a finished product yet. I think patriotism is more than just arbitrarily wearing a certain logo on your shirt or having flags in your yard. It's really about loving what the country is and still wanting and striving it for it to be better. This is like with my children. I love my children unconditionally, but I don't always agree with everything they do, and I still want them to strive to be better people. And it's the same thing with America. You can love it, but you still want to see it be better. You still want it to be more equitable and more fair for all of its citizens and non-citizens.
We heard from listeners Drew Baker, Mike Ahern, Penny Maliska, Jinga Nemchechwa, Alexandra Cole, and Brandon Smith. And you can share your thoughts about what it is to be an American at hereandnow.org.
If you're the lightest shade of brown, is it cool to call yourself a person of color?
It does not feel right for me.
I absolutely want to own my space as a feminist woman of color.
Don't miss our series exploring Latino identity on NPR's Code Switch podcast.
Tropical Storm Elsa is sweeping along the coast of Cuba today. The storm, which killed at least 3 people in the Caribbean islands, is then expected to head to Florida, where a state of emergency has been declared in 15 counties, including Miami-Dade County, where that high-rise condominium collapsed. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jane. Good afternoon.
Well, thank you. What are you seeing in general as you watch Elsa today?
Well, it's a tropical storm. It's not all put together like a hurricane. It's a bit disorganized, but it's certainly a strong tropical storm. It's on the upper end. It's moving across Cuba at the present time. And we have a lot of thunderstorm activity circling around it. It's certainly some tropical storm winds. And it's going to be moving over this island today. And that's we're going to learn a lot more about Elsa once it emerges on the other side of Cuba later tonight.
Well, tell us about the track. I know we're watching it closely. I mentioned the state of emergency now in effect in those 15 counties in Florida. What part of Florida is most at risk, and what's the timeline here?
Well, beginning late tonight and early tomorrow morning, the Keys will likely see tropical storm conditions, tropical storm warnings in effect there, and those warnings do extend now up the west coast of Florida. We're looking at southwest Florida and west central Florida. So from Tampa to Sarasota, the Bradenton area, Fort Myers, Naples, and the Keys will take the brunt of Elsa, especially Tuesday into Tuesday night. With tropical storm winds, there's also a concern for some storm surge flooding, depending on the exact track, but we've got a storm surge watch up and down the coast. And there also may be enough wind to produce wind damage right along the coast. We're also going to keep an eye on those outer bands that could spread far inland across Florida and produce a tornado risk and some heavy rain with this tropical storm. Thankfully, it's moving swift enough that the rainfall won't be a significant widespread flooding concern, but with any tropical system, you can have some localized flooding.
Well, you mentioned all of it, the storm surge watch, the winds, the flooding. I mean, if you were to, put your money on this, what's the biggest concern out of Elsa?
Well, I encourage all Floridians, especially in the southwest part of the state, there near Naples and Fort Myers, to certainly be checking in throughout the day today and tonight and early tomorrow morning. Because, Jane, when a storm crosses an island like Cuba, it can sometimes disrupt the circulation. And more often than not, it does weaken. But sometimes the storm could reorganize quickly because the waters between Key West and Cuba are very warm and the environmental conditions could allow for some strengthening. So we still have time to watch this and maybe make some sudden decisions if we need to in terms of preparing a little more. But right now, I think it's best for most Floridians to plan on riding this out inside and staying away from trees and power lines that might come down, especially near the coast with those stronger wind gusts. And if you're in a storm surge flood prone area, you may want to seek higher ground and listen to your local officials for any possible evacuation orders coming out later today.
Jeff, we've had several conversations with you, especially during the 2020 hurricane season, which was record breaking. Are you watching any other storms develop behind Elsa?
Thankfully, no, especially considering it's kind of hard to wrap your head around that we are pacing ahead of last year in terms of the number of storms at this time. But right now, no additional development expected in the Atlantic Basin over the next 5 days.
All right. Jeff Huffman is Director and Chief Meteorologist for the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thank you for your time. Good luck.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Sam Sifton has always had his finger on the pulse of how America cooks. Sifton is the food editor of the New York Times and co-founder of New York Times Cooking. In the past few years, and especially during the pandemic, Sifton has become a proponent of what he calls no-recipe recipes, so much so that he's written a book about it, aptly titled The New York Times Cooking No-Recipe Recipes. I spoke with Sam Sifton back in March when the book came out, and I began by asking him where this idea for the no-recipe recipe came from.
Well, it came from a number of different directions all at once and slowly, if that's possible. The fact of the matter is, I spend a lot of time with recipes, right? And I spend a lot of time thinking about how to make bad recipes into good recipes or unhelpful recipes into helpful recipes. But at the same time, I realize I spend a lot of time talking with people about food and telling them how to make something. And when we do that, we don't really talk about specific amounts or oven temperatures. It's a hot oven, a medium oven, a low oven. It's a fistful of mint rather than three tablespoons or what have you. And I thought to myself, you know, I might want to bring a little bit of that into the newsletter that I write for NYT Cooking, What to Cook, as a way of kind of offering a new way of thinking about food so that you don't have to always follow a recipe. You can kind of riff on something as a kind of improvisation rather than following the sheet music really closely. And I did that on Wednesdays for a bunch of years. And then some smart cookie was like, maybe we should put this together in a book.
Take us through one of your no-recipe recipes and tell us how your instructions then differ from what we may be used to seeing.
Well, sure, I can do that. I've got a recipe, a no-recipe recipe here for a kale salad with cranberries, pecans, and blue cheese. You make a mustardy vinaigrette that'll stand up to the greens. That's mustard, it's olive oil, a little lemon juice, salt, and pepper. And you drizzle that over some stemmed and chopped kale, and then you put in some like big flavored mix-ins. That could be anything. I use dried cranberries and some pecans, and then I put in some crumbled blue cheese and some croutons because it's sweet, it's salty, it's spicy, it's sour, and then I serve it with some red wine. Why don't we eat salads for dinner more often? That's all you got to do.
So people think you were just telling me that, but you were actually reading that because I was reading along with you, page 66. That was
there
the recipe.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the recipe, but it doesn't have to be the recipe. You could put dried currants in there instead of the cranberries. You could use a different kind of nut. You could use a different kind of cheese. You can make the meal however you want to make the meal.
Yeah.
And I think that it's neat to tell people that they can do that now because most of us have been cooking more over the course of the past year than we ever have cooked in our lives. So I think kitchen confidence is up a little, and I hope that a book like No Recipe Recipes can reward that confidence with some ideas for what to do with your skills. Mm.
So here's another one, rotisserie chicken panzanella. And here is your recipe. Tear a rotisserie chicken into strips and pieces, then cut a few smallish supermarket tomatoes, or better ones if you've got them, into wedges and marinate them in olive oil, salt, pepper, and red wine vinegar. Pay a few bills or fold some laundry and then turn the whole thing into panzanella by mixing together the chicken, tomatoes, some watercress, and several handfuls of croutons. Shower the salad with pepper and add a spray of salt. This, too, is cooking.
Yes, that's a good salad.
That is a good. Well, I got to tell you, I made the roasted cauliflower soup because I had a head of cauliflower and I thought, okay, I'm going to try it out. Sam says I can do this. And sure enough, I did not have artichokes. And so I used hearts of palm. And
oh, cool.
It was pretty good. I have to say, it was pretty good.
That's cool. I love it with the hearts of palm. What a neat idea.
So you just said that cooking without a recipe is like musical improvisation, a skill, right? I mean, a lot of people will say, well, it's hard to trust yourself, you know, and you don't want to mess up a good dish. To mm-hmm. which you say what, Sam Sifton?
Well, what I say to that is you're probably not going to mess it up. What we're doing here is roasting, we're steaming, we're boiling, we're braising, we're grilling. All those things are like, that's at the base. We know how to do that. And we've been doing it, as I say, for a year now straight.
Mm-hmm.
And then to build flavors, we're just making little triangles of sweet, salty, and fiery, or sour, and umami-ish, and bitter. And you just kind of play things off one another in ways that are pleasing to you.
Mm. So you don't need a recipe, but you do need a pantry, which you say right in the beginning of the book. And you have a list of essentials, things like onions and flour and cornstarch and butter and dried fruits. What ingredients are at the top of that list for you, Sam, as far as pantry items that you really need to keep stocked?
For me, the most important thing is to have a lot of condiments, because mm-hmm. condiments help deliver flavor. So that could be as simple as hot sauce. It could be gochujang, the Korean hot pepper mm-hmm. sauce. I mean, sauce, paste. It could be a flavored oil, like a sesame oil is a good thing to have. You should always have some anchovies on hand, tomato paste on hand. You should always have soy sauce on hand. You should maybe always have fish sauce on hand, mm-hmm. depending on what direction your cooking goes. I find that having a stocked pantry makes it unbelievably easy to riff, because you can, if you think, oh, I need something salty, you can go to those anchovies. If I need something sweet, I can make a decision. Maybe I'll use this molasses. Maybe I'll use maple syrup. Maybe I'll use honey.
And like you say, it seems that pantry cooking is what we've been doing. A lot of us have been doing for the past year. You know, how can I cook this can of beans differently tonight? Right.
Right. I mean, that's right.
So what other shifts in cooking habits have you seen over the past year at New York Times Cooking?
One of the things that I've noticed is that I think I have a suspicion that portion size is coming down for a lot of people.
Mm.
I mean, there are a lot of people who spent a lot of the pandemic alone or with yeah. one or two other people. And they have no use of a giant vat of stew or beans. So they're looking for smaller serving sizes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may ultimately be a good thing for our readers' health, that we're eating a little less. I certainly don't miss it.
What else is in your mailbox, Sam Sifton? I mean, what other kinds of recipes would you say readers are calling for these days?
Well, there's an overwhelming desire for, and I realize this may contradict what I just said a little bit, but an overwhelming desire for comfort. We're hurting now at the tail end of this thing, even as maybe because there's some hope on the horizon and we're still stuck here. And the recipes that people are asking for don't necessarily reflect that so much as they reflect a desire to feel loved, to feel taken care of, to feel nourished. Mm. So those stews, smaller but still stews, mm-hmm. those braises, smaller but still braised and delicious, big flavors, sauces, and the like.
A quick shout out to those people who are just flat tired of cooking during the pandemic, Sam. I mean, to those people, you say what? That must happen to you too.
Oh, absolutely. And what I say often is, give yourself a break, order a pizza, and try as much as possible to make the act of cooking an intentional one that brings joy into your life as opposed to drudgery into your life.
And so as we're slowly opening up after the pandemic, do you see people still cooking, still going at it in the kitchen?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. I think that one thing that people have learned a lot about over the course of the past year is food cost. And they see that by cooking at home, they're saving money and they're making the flavors that they want. You can roast an excellent chicken at home in about the time that it takes to go get one elsewhere, and more cheaply too. And I think that'll keep people cooking. And I think people have learned that they like to cook. And I think that'll keep them cooking as well.
New York Times food editor Sam Sifton's new book is The New York Times Cooking No Recipe Recipes. Sam, as always, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure to be here. I'm glad you liked the book.
The Federal Reserve has had to bring interest rates to emergency lows several times over the last 20 years. First, during the dot-com crash after 9/11, in the wake of the Great Recession, and now due to the pandemic. While low rates have been a boon for companies and investors, stocks and real estate are at all-time highs. They have walloped millions of people who have put money into traditional savings accounts. Robin Farzad is here to explain why. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
I'm well. Keeping interest rates so low has been great for investors, but it's also created this forgotten class of savers. Robin, explain why.
Yeah, it's really been an afterthought, I think, for the better part of 20 years. The central bank, time and again, has been all about slashing interest rates to induce spending and investment. That's helped stocks, it's helped real estate, all manner of risk assets, and the Fed is even buying bonds to further keep its thumb on the scale. But that's cold comfort for those who've seen even ever smaller yields on the cash that they've worked hard to save. I mean, whether you're talking savings accounts, CDs, money market funds, or even shorter treasuries that are yielding next to nil. And it's twice the insult, say, if you were saving for a house or some other asset that's no longer in your window of affordability.
So beyond the past 20 years or so, are there any other times in history that have been this bad for savers?
I mean, when you have a deep recession or depression, I mean, there's a prolonged period of low interest rates in the modern Federal Reserve period of the past 100 years or so. I'd say, rates are slashed to inflate the economy. It's just this rolling bubble period of the past two decades that particularly grabs my eyes. I will say also that the period of inflation in the 70s and 80s saw yields that were, on the face of it, they were very fat. I remember going with my dad to Savings of America in North Miami 40 years ago. They were giving us toasters and blenders, but it was a fool's errand because in real terms, when you account for the burn of inflation, we weren't really clearing anything after the bank was paying us 12 or 13%. The Federal Reserve, indeed, back then had to hike to the high teens to attempt to sop excess cash from the economy. Now it is at zero.
Well, and what does this mean for the wealth gap in this country, Robin? And have these low rates worsened that divide?
Shed a tear for the elderly, those on fixed incomes, the disabled, those who haven't been able to partake in, say, stock, real estate, cryptomania, and are going to emerge from this crisis worse off relatively than those with risk assets. We do know that U.S. households now have $1.9 trillion in excess savings, money socked away above what they normally would have had. And banks don't seem to really want that cash. It's, you know, the Fed and the system are trying to force risk-taking, and people are going to be out there hunting for yield. And I worry that those out of desperation that are trying to manufacture some sort of yield that will give them a standard of living are going to get hurt.
Well, the other issue, of course, is inflation, which has been rising over the past few months as the economy rapidly picks up again. And Americans are about to start spending all that money they saved over the pandemic, Robin. So what can we do to protect our savings as inflation rises?
Jane, this has always been such a Rorschach on Wall Street. Depends on who you ask. There are treasury inflation protected securities for the wonks out there if you want to ratchet up your return with inflation. But there are other schools of thought that believe you should delve into precious metals, commodities such as oil, farmland, timber, even real estate and stocks hedge against inflation, even though they are very richly valued right now. And let's not even get into crypto. That's a whole new, bizarre new world. I think, you know, a painful scenario will ensue if someone out there right now accepts, say, 1.5 points of yield on a 10-year treasury, and they end up having buyer's remorse if inflation shoots well above that while they have to hold for 9 or 10 years. This is the problem out there. A lot of people who are pursuing risk assets don't realize the risk of inflation or the risk of a bubble.
Well, banks often require customers to have a minimum amount of money in a savings account. What's your advice? Should we just keep the minimum in that account and put the rest of our money elsewhere? What do you say?
It's so hard to give one-size-fits-all advice for this because you do hear a lot of traders that say cash is trash. And that's a privileged thing to be able to say because you're assuming that someone has more cash stashed away and they can go out and take a flyer on stocks and maybe see stocks fall 10, 20, 30%. Real estate, that they're liquid enough to go out there and pay this much down and get a mortgage. In the end, cash is cash, and it's the only thing that you're going to truly have in an emergency scenario. And you have to hold your nose and you have to bite the bullet and keep it in an account. Right now, the banks aren't going to do you any favors to try to attract your cash. But like I say, it's the coldest of comforts, and to see all this fear of missing out while risk assets are going up. But there inevitably has to be some sort of judgment day for this. There has to be some sort of vindication for doing your best, being on your best behavior, and holding cash despite the pain of doing so.
That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jane Clayson. Have a good holiday and do stay safe. This is Here and Now.